This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has a website dedicated to global climate change. Across the top of the home webpage, it has a series of numbers that are constantly updated. Carbon dioxide is at its highest concentration in the atmosphere in 650,000 years, the metrics say, at 402 parts per million. Global temperature has risen 1.4 degrees since 1980. Sea level is rising 3.38 millimeters per year. The numbers are striking when you see them laid out in front of you, but they can be a little hard to relate to. What does that actually mean for you, for us, here in New England, in Vermont? Today we're going to talk about Vermont's climate future, what we're already experiencing, and what that means for the future. Our guests say things are changing, but as you get out 20 or 40 years, there are enough variables that we don't know exactly what our landscape is going to look like. So we'll look at the potential range and what that's likely to mean for our agriculture, our ecology, tourism, everything else. I'm joined in the studio now by Jillian Galford. She's an Earth System Scientist at UVM's Gund Institute and lead author of the Vermont Climate Assessment. Jillian, nice to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
And on the phone with us from Paul Smith's College is Kurt Steger, professor in the School of Natural Resource Management and Ecology. He's the author of Deep Future, the Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Kurt, it's a pleasure to have you back as well.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
So for both of you, let's just lay down some basic understanding of the broad issue of climate change for just 1 minute before we narrow our focus to Vermont. Jillian Galford, how fast is the climate changing?
It's changing more rapidly than we've ever seen on geologic timescales. Both Kurt and I have geologic experience. That is, our educational background comes from geology. And we've never seen this rate of change as fast as it's occurring today.
And as I said, on the NASA webpage, if you go look at it, it says the Earth has risen 1.4 degrees since 1980. And that sounds about right to you. That looks like the right projection.
Yeah. And in fact, that's very similar to what we've experienced here in Vermont.
Something like 1.3 degrees, you said a couple years ago.
1.3 degrees since about 1960. But almost half of that increase in temperature has occurred just since 1990 here in Vermont.
And Kurt Steger, maybe this seems derivative, but why? Why is the climate changing so fast?
Well, climate always changes, and we know that from the geological perspective, too. And that actually leads a lot of kind of sincere, skeptical questioning people to say, how do you know it's due to us and not some of these natural cycles? And the fact is, we do know because we understand the cycles. There's nothing happening with the changes in the sun's output, really, that would explain the warming. Nothing really happening with volcanoes or anything, which basically leaves the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that's mainly due to us. So, yes, climate always changes, but we're changing the baseline and shifting it towards a warmer baseline.
We got a couple of emails from listeners before the show on this same theme. So I'm going to read you one of them and hope that you can help explain what our listeners are thinking about and how you see it. Adam says, I take it as a given that Homo sapiens have contributed to climate change. It also should be accepted that Earth is currently in an ice age, ice house phase. Additionally, due to positions of land masses and other factors, it seems likely that the interglacial period we are in would end in a glacial period, colder temperatures. I also take it as accepted that the climate is constantly changing and that the ice house state is the exception, not the norm for Earth. Therefore, why should humanity want it to get colder instead of warmer? We have to pick one, assuming we have the ability to influence the climate state.
You want to take that, Jillian, or I could do it?
Go for it.
Really, the main job, I think, of the scientists is to show that the change is real and that we're causing it and what direction it's going in. So we know that we're causing changes that would not have happened if we didn't run our civilization on fossil fuels. The next question is to broaden the dialogue now that we've documented that and really include everybody to say, well, obviously any direction the climate changes is going to have winners and losers, as it always had. The biggest question is the ethics of it. Climate has always changed. There's always been winners and losers, but this time we're doing it on purpose. So that adds an ethical dimension that basically means we all need to talk about who decides what the climate is.
And this idea that again, Adam and another listener wrote that actually somebody wrote to us and said, actually, we should be seeing glaciers increase starting right about now, not decrease. Does that just not follow the science that you're seeing, Jillian Galford?
We're talking about two different timescales, right? So geologic timescale, we're starting to think in tens of thousands of years to hundreds of thousands of years. And with climate change, we're really seeing things change over the course of a few decades. Kurt, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, it's really hard for us to kind of deal on a daily basis with the differences in the time scales, you know, centuries, thousands of years, our single lifetimes and things. And even for, you know, professionals like us, it's kind of hard. So it's important not to confuse the geologic time scale. Yes, indeed, since the time of the dinosaurs, the Earth has cooled. And yes, you know, for 2-3 million years, we've had ice ages. But that's not what's happening now.
All right, listeners, I want to invite you into this conversation. As you can see, we've already had people weighing in, asking questions, thinking about this issue. We're going to be talking about Vermont's changing climate and not on that tens of thousands of year scale, but really 20, 30 years in our lifetimes, in our children's lifetimes. What's it going to look like and how different will it be? Are winters going to be the same? It sounds like not. It sounds like less snow, maybe very much less snow. So what does that mean for our economy, for tourism, for people who like to ski or who rely on the winter economy? What is going to change in our ecology? What's going to change in the way we think about our government, education? If you have a question, if you'd like to add your thoughts, maybe how you're preparing, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So let's talk just also here as we're having this sort of baseline conversation about the difference between weather and climate change. And, you know, I think everybody now is aware that we don't point to individual weather events as something that is provably climate change related. But, you know, when we see T-shirt weather on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and then today we see the, you know, sort of subarctic feeling weather that we have, you do have people who say either proof of global warming or negating global warming. And we know that that's not the case, each individual weather event. But what are you seeing in the weather in terms of patterns that you point to as a sign of what is actually happening with climate change in our region? Jillian Galford.
So, Jane, I think one important connection between global climate change and what we see in Vermont is really thinking about the chain of events. So you mentioned NASA is documenting increased CO2 in the atmosphere. So CO2 is a gas that we're producing as humans. It traps heat. And as you add heat to that atmosphere, you're increasing the temperature. Well, warmer air can actually hold more water. So as temperatures increase, we get more evaporation, say in the tropics. The atmosphere in general is holding more water. That water circulates all around the world. And what ends up happening is places like Vermont and the Northeast in general are receiving a lot of that water. We've seen increases in precipitation since 1990s, where, you know, we've increased our annual precipitation by 3 inches per year. We are seeing a lot of this precipitation falling in defined events. So it's not that every rainfall of the year has more rain. It's that we're getting these really big storms at certain times.
Or even that we have more days of rain. It's just that in an event, there's more rain coming down.
Yeah.
In that one event.
So if we look, for example, at the number of days where we have more than 1 inch of precipitation, 1 inch is considered a pretty big amount of water in just a day. We've increased from, say, 4 days like that per year 20 or 30 years ago to now having that happen 10 or 12 days per year. Areas like Rutland have seen the greatest increase in those high precipitation events, which Rutland, if you ask anyone who lives in Rutland, they feel it. They see the flooding in their communities and such. The other thing that's happening is as the energy balance in the Earth system is shifting, we're getting weather patterns that our local meteorologists have never seen before in their careers. So we're in some ways seeing new patterns, like these blocking patterns, where we get these May rains that are cold and wet for just 7, 10, 12 days. And the meteorologists don't know how to put these in their models. They're not part of our observed history. So we're getting new patterns of weather that come along with these increases in temperature and increases in precipitation.
Some of the things that we've been seeing, like weather patterns just sticking around for a while, is that also?
Those are the blocking patterns.
So that like long stretch of whatever it is, the same weather, that's a difference from what
we've seen in the past. Yeah, last winter I think we had 10 days of extremely, extremely cold weather. That was because we got stuck with this polar air just funneling right down on Vermont.
Kurt Steiger, when we think about, okay, so, you know, some more events that have more rain or these somewhat changeable patterns that we've seen now, these blocking patterns where weather will stick around for a while, does that actually change things? I mean, it's easy to say, yeah, fine. And certainly something like Tropical Storm Irene was a massive event that changed a lot of lives and changed a lot of Vermont. But overall, do we see things changing? I mean, a couple degrees here and there, a couple more rain events. Is that actually changing our ecology and our climate?
Well, absolutely. You'll see changes, not just because you'd say there'd be more rainstorms or anything like that, but like Jillian's saying, if you leave your weather pattern in place for longer, it makes the effects more intense. So if you have a hot spell, let's say in the summer, that lasts twice as long as it used to, that makes more evaporation and creates a drought situation. It dries out the soil, dries out lakes and things like that. You know, it makes the lake levels go down. And by the same token, if you have your kind of run-of-the-mill rainstorm sitting on top of you for day after day, you can raise river levels and lake levels too. So that has direct implications for anybody that lives near a river or uses a road that is a culvert that doesn't handle the water anymore.
I mean, when we think about are things actually changing with just what we're seeing now, I was reading Jillian Galford, the Vermont Climate Assessment from a couple years ago now that you were the lead author on. And some of it, you know, sounds almost comical in the sense that you said spring is starting 2 or 3 days earlier than usual. And obviously not spring when it actually starts on the calendar, but in terms of when we see the thawing out. And so we have, you know, 3 or 4 more days of the growing season. That doesn't seem like much, you know, when you think, great, 3 or 4 more days before I have a frost at the end of the year or I get to grow a little bit. But we're also seeing crops that we never saw before. You know, people are growing peaches now here in the last couple decades that we didn't used to have. Are there other things that you can point to that are actually happening because of something that seems so small when we just think about it as 2 or 3 extra days of a growing season?
Yeah, so the growing season actually is averaging 3.7, so almost 4 days longer per decade. So at that rate, it actually changes pretty fast. We've already seen Vermont shift in the USDA classification of hardiness zones from 4 to 5 in many of our regions, which if you're a gardener, you've noticed that. It shifts what you can put in your garden. We're seeing in Vermont people planting new varietals of wine grapes, for example. People are experimenting with peaches, which don't typically survive the hardiness of the Vermont winter. There's new varieties of tomatoes and melons and things like that that need just a few days longer in the growing season to be a good crop for farmers. So people are already experimenting in that. We're seeing more hoop houses, greenhouses, things like that going in to really capture that extension of the season. And Vermonters are demanding it. People love buying fresh local produce here. I think people are already experimenting. I think there is some risk, particularly to our fruit trees and shrubs that require, for example, apples and blueberries want 1,000 hours below 45 degrees to stimulate the growth in the set of the flowers. And that's to get a profitable yield. So you could imagine a winter that was extremely mild could actually cut into some of our more traditional crops.
So we may be getting some great peaches, but maybe over time, fewer blueberries.
Exactly. And I think everything is like that when we think about the future. It's about risk management. So as we look at increasing precipitation over the next 20 or 30 years, we're going to have a lot of winter snow. And it's kind of, as we say, the climate sweet spot if you're a winter recreation enthusiast. If you're like my husband who coaches spring lacrosse, it means their fields are wet and flooded, and they often have games canceled because they can't get out on the fields at those times. And so communities have to start thinking about how they change things. Do they invest in turf? Do they improve fields with better drainage? How do they adapt to guarantee this quality of life?
Kurt Steiger, look into the future with us, 20, 30 years. I mean, within many of our lifetimes and within a generation or two, what happens here in Vermont to precipitation, to temperature? What should we actually be anticipating?
Well, for one thing, of course, because natural climate change is still going on, you'll have super cold winters, then the mild winter that would have happened anyway, or the hot and dries wet and dries and things happening like that. So what's going to happen, though, is there's this slow rising tide of temperature under that that makes it difficult for an individual to notice without, you know, having a long-term weather record to look at, or things like in the climate assessment that Jillian's been talking about that really help you see the long-term pattern. So during the lifetime of people listening to the show right now, you could say, if you live a long, full life and you're a young person now, winters will be milder. There'll be ice on the lakes for less time in the winter. It'll be thinner, too, and there'll be pretty much a sign that there's a cultural ecological shift from being less and less like, you know, the Vermont and New England Adirondacks that we kind of grew up with, where you think of it as being defined by winter, kind of a long-term directional shift in coming generations where it'll be more and more like maybe the Blue Ridge or something like that. Where, as we were saying, you know, you have fewer of the things we take for granted like blueberries and more of the things like the grapes or things like that. So I'd say the biggest change you're going to watch for is milder winters and hotter summers, basically.
When you say milder winters, should we anticipate no more skiing or very little skiing?
Well, in the long run, it's going to be doomed. But like Jillian was saying, there will be probably a near-term sweet spot for places like Vermont because, as you can see around the world, you know, places like the Alps, even the Rockies, whatever, in the long term, the ski industry will be shrinking. And so there may actually be a sweet spot of time in the near future where Vermont will be one of the few remaining destinations that you want to go to. So it might actually, you know, kind of increase for a while. But in the long term, it's going to end.
Jillian Galford, what about sugaring? Another big part of the Vermont and the local identity is maple sugaring in the springtime. But with global climate change and with what we're seeing here, are we going to see sugar maples struggling?
We've already seen a lot of threats to, in particular, sugar maple. Part of that is wetter winters and dry summer stress has already caused sugar maple and as well as species like red spruce to decline to some extent. So it's going to be really important that whether it's UVM Extension or farmers associations really help people figure out how to manage these trees to ensure their long-term production. I think one of the most unique characteristics about maple sugar in Vermont is that we use wild sugar bushes. We don't have the agroforestry that's happening more to the north. So you might think in the future, are we going to have to go to more of an agroforestry model? Or perhaps we'll develop new techniques that help us extract the sugar better from the tree, which we're already seeing in development here in Vermont. For certain, the variability year to year, which is what we were just talking about, is going to be huge. You might have a boom one year because the conditions are just right, and the next year it could be a total bust. And I think maple sugars of anyone in Vermont knows that the best, right? It's very hard to know if you're going to have a really good year or if it's just going to warm up very quick and you won't be able to sugar for very long.
So we're talking today about Vermont and our northern New England, northern United States changing climate over the next 20, 30 years. We'd like to know from you, I mean, if you're thinking about this, Jillian Galford mentioned, I mean, this affects everybody, even places like municipalities and schools thinking about, do we put in turf in the springtime if we're likely to have wetter springs and less time for our sports teams to get out there on the fields? It's not just what happens in the wintertime and what is a little bit of temperature here or there. I mean, we're talking about changes in our lifestyle. So I'd like to know from you, listeners, how would your life change if we had a different kind of winter in terms of lifestyle? Maybe you could handle it, but what about your local economy? Maybe your own profession relies on climate in some way or another. How are you looking ahead to what our future climate will mean for all of us? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Ellen and Cabot, we're going to get to you next. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're exploring what's likely, what's possible in terms of Vermont's climate in the future. More precipitation, probably in the form of rain, we're hearing. Perhaps much less snow in the long term, somewhat long term. Changes to our sugaring industry, winter sports, spring sports for high schools, tourism, agriculture. Our guests are Kurt Steger, a professor at Paul Smith's College, and he's in the School of Natural Resource Management and Ecology, also the author of Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth, And Jillian Galford, an Earth Systems scientist at UVM's Gund Institute and lead author of the Vermont Climate Assessment that looks at a lot of the stuff we're talking about today. If you have a question or a comment on what you're hearing, call 1-800-639-2211 or carry the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Ellen, I promised we'd go to you. You're in Cabot. What are your thoughts as you listen to this conversation?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I have three quick points, and you can tackle them in any way you want. Mostly it has to do with language around this issue. And the first thing I'd like to say is that I think talking about climate change or climate warming is too fuzzy and warm for what seems to be going on. And I think changing the nomenclature to something like destabilized climate or climate instability or something that really generates some anxiety, because that's really my understanding is that civilization never really settled down until the climate settled down. We weren't able to have an agriculture until the climate settled down. Second point I'd like to say is I had a conversation with someone recently, and I was saying, yeah, this climate thing, you know, at 2 degrees, first of all, they're talking Celsius, so it's a lot more Fahrenheit, and also that my understanding is that 5 degrees Celsius is climate disaster. So again, use of language, if you only talk about it 2 degrees and you don't talk about that 2 degrees is very large quantity of 5 degrees.
And this is 2 degrees Celsius, the global average temperature increase and some of what the international community is trying to curb it so that we only have 2 degrees Celsius of warming. But go ahead, Ellen.
Right, exactly. So not being very clear. Okay, and then the last point is just about the way we talk about the economy. And you've already mentioned some of these things, and that's great. But I wish that was happening a lot more in the media, which is we're always being told, oh, it's too expensive to do anything about global warming. For God's sake, can't we start talking about how costly it is to do nothing? Witness all the flooding in the Missouri, that we're not going to have any snow in Vermont, and also forest fires. And then also I noticed last spring in Cabot, I had an extremely late frost in the spring. So it wasn't just that I had a longer growing season. I actually had the same length of growing season.
Yeah, Ellen, thanks for your points. And I take all of them. We're going to weave them into the conversation as we carry this on and look at what actually are people doing. And we're going to ask Jillian Galford and Kurt Steger what they're seeing in terms of action and preparation on those fronts that you were mentioning. But let's get another couple of thoughts in here as we carry on this conversation. Steve is calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Steve. Go right ahead.
I'm wondering if folks are doing any economic development planning at the state level for contingency planning for in the event that our snow and ski tourism season is severely impacted many years in a row. What kind of planning should be going on to restructure or reorganize our economy?
Steve, thanks for
you. Who should put pressure to make sure that happens?
Yeah, Steve, good question. And, you know, I think we could ask Jillian Galford what she's seeing. But beyond just what's happening with state government and municipalities, this is something surely that affects business entities and the resorts that we've seen and the economies that surround them. So what are you seeing in all forms of preparation for people actually looking ahead to 30 or 50 years and saying things are going to change?
Yeah, I think all of the risk management activities or development activities that we see happening already happen either on the private level or to some extent on the public level. So with the example of thinking of tourist dollars, an average family of four who comes to Vermont for a weekend of skiing spends the same amount of money in that weekend as a similar family who spends 2 weeks here in the summer. So we have really these high impact in terms of dollars coming into Vermont, these high impact winter activities going on. So the question is, when we think about spring and summer activities, are there other high value activities that will entice people here? So part of that certainly could come from the state. I think we're already seeing a lot of our ski areas ensuring that they have activities families want to do if they come on a vacation and there's no snow, or
so
to
for
extend
example, saying something like a water park,
and extending into the summer with, you know, golf amenities and spas and things like that that still attract people to the area. So yeah, I think those are definitely big issues. I think a lot of this planning and development is going to have to shift the paradigm of how we think. We were talking about schools earlier. You know, schools are usually these big box buildings that would be really ideal for putting solar panels on them, but they're owned in complex ways. They're public buildings. You know, most of our solar panel companies are private. So there's these complexities that right now a lot of our communities are not set up to create adaptations that would help them. So we need to just start thinking outside the box. How do we do that? How do we get it done?
So it sounds like you are seeing, especially in some private entities that are thinking ahead to their own bottom line, you're seeing some change, but not enough. I mean, if you look at it, globally is the wrong word since we're looking locally today, but are you seeing a lot of thinking on this or not enough?
I think we need to do more. I think Vermonters are sort of at the front of the curve when we look nationally. So we have been engaged in resilience planning at the community level for a number of years, and resilience is a common part of the Vermont vocabulary. And I think that sets us ahead, that we already have a mentality to build resilience. And resilience, in some ways, is the same thing as risk management. So how do we make steady changes and hedge our bets as we go? Is that through private things like additional insurance for farmers or economic education to help farmers build a nest egg in case they have a really bad year? Is it public bailouts? You know, there's a whole range of options, but we certainly need to be thinking about all of those.
We got a note from the Climate Change Project-Based Learning class at Randolph Union High School, and they wrote to tell us that they're listening to this show. And they ask, in science and social studies, we often study the world as it was or as it is. How can teachers and curriculum be best oriented toward the uncertainties of the changing world that climate change will bring us? Kurt Steger, you've thought about this. How would you respond?
Well, I think this is a great challenge of the young generation now, and although I get depressed looking at a lot of the science here, I'm actually inspired that folks high school age, college age, a lot of them are really rallying to this. So I say more power to you, you folks in the schools right now. So first of all, this is a great way to learn basic science, which you need to do to understand how the world works. So it gives you a context. If you learn what climate is and what ecology is, that helps you understand what we're headed for and why we're connected to the Earth like that. But they're also using the social studies is blending communication skills and the arts in getting the science across effectively. So you really need that alliance of the two, the arts and the sciences, to really make changes. And so there are activities going on. I presume maybe Randolph Union High School has got some events happening, but there are things like the Youth Climate Summit that was held recently in Burlington. I think it's been 2 years now. They started here in the Adirondacks and are spreading around the country now. So I think it's a great opportunity for young folks to grab onto this. And
you know, when we were hearing from Ellen, though, a moment ago, saying, you know, there's a big difference in what the effects are going to be if the globe rises 2 degrees Celsius or if it rises 5 degrees Celsius. And a lot of that depends on what we as communities and as government actors do in the next 10, 15 years. So how do teachers and students in a class like this try to think out to 30 or 40 or 50 years or when they're going to be adults leading the world when so much is uncertain right now?
Sure. Well, the one important thing to do is to realize, yes, there's some uncertainty, but there's a lot of certainty as well. We know what's happening. We know, like, why the change is happening. We know it's getting warmer. The uncertainty things are, you know, like, what's the exact temperature range or something that it's going to go up. We do know that the warmer it gets, the more severe the consequences are, too. So I think it's important when we're teaching this topic in the schools is to sift out what we really know and how much the uncertainty is there. Like, well, for example, in the climate assessment that Jillian was working on, it was great because you can put down there what are the things we're most certain about and least certain. So I think it's just important to take it as a sort of a learning moment of how does science work? What is certainty, and how do we know what we know? And there certainly is a lot that we can then take action on. And also ask you, you know, how do we power our civilization, and how do I live my life in a way that makes sense in this new context, and how do we build a more resilient, sustainable civilization?
Well, and speaking of that climate assessment, we have a link to it at vpr.net if you click on today's show page, so you can see what Jillian Gelford and the others who are working on this look at in terms of projections and the sort of lower range projection and higher range projection and what those both might mean. But Jillian, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I think from a science perspective, a lot of these systems, the numbers might change, but these pathways by which we see change happening, those are stable. So learning those pathways, learning that as CO2 increases, temperature increases. As temperature increases, we have more precipitation in the atmosphere. We get more rain in Vermont, and we have to adapt our communities to flooding. So understanding those sort of chain of events and linkages among the system, then you can adjust those parameters as we see more CO2 or maybe a end to the increasing rate of CO2 emissions. So I think understanding those systems and how they function and how they affect each other is really the key. And we can change the numbers. And as we get more certainty in certain areas, we can refine our results. But understanding that framework is really important. And I think this next generation of students coming to us are getting better at integrating the natural sciences and the social sciences. And I think that's really key to addressing these issues.
Let's go to Ryan calling in from Norwich. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Great.
So I actually live in Norwich and work for a solar company there named Solflex. And the town, and that's including the municipal buildings, the fire station, the police station, the school, have contracted with our company to provide solar power to them. And even though there's not a good spot to put solar right there, we have community solar parks where we can credit the energy to these buildings. So I think some of that stuff doesn't need to come from the private companies, but from pressures within the town.
Ryan, good point. So looking at what communities are already doing to be solar powered, to look at the future, and we're seeing as we kick off the legislative session tomorrow, there are going to be more questions about energy power and caps and how we decide what we want to do about carbon emissions and do we want a carbon tax and a lot of those questions coming up. Ryan's saying in Norwich, they're already thinking about this. They're already making themselves a solar powered town. Let's go to Brown, also calling in from Norwich. Hi, Brown. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm wondering about wildlife management and the recent tick infestation that's sweeping through. And I realize we've now closed our borders to transportation of firewood and other timber products. So I guess that's a trend.
Brown, thanks for the call. Yeah, just briefly, Jillian Gelford, what are we seeing in terms of insect infestation and more of that, looking at Lyme disease certainly rising as we've seen more ticks in this region too?
Yeah, both invasive bugs as well as invasive plants and then even the pests that we see. With a shorter winter or a longer growing season, we may see more of those as populations are able to increase. As a hiker, I worry a lot about poison ivy. Poison ivy actually, as CO2 increases, it becomes more and more toxic. It actually carries more toxins in it. So that's scary stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, great. Great place to end. Thanks, Jillian. Certainly, this is not the end of this conversation, but end of our conversation for this program. Listeners, I'd love for you to carry on your thoughts here. We've got comments from Brad and Elizabeth thinking about climate change, thinking about the effects, thinking about how we should talk about this. So carry on that conversation. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Jillian Gelford is an Earth System Scientist at UVM's Gund Institute for Ecological Economics and the lead author of the Vermont Climate Assessment. Kurt Steger is a professor at Paul Smith's College. He's in the School of Natural Resource Management and Ecology. And he's the author of Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Thanks very much to both of you for being on this show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in our book club for kids, we take a deep look at The Crossover by Kwame Alexander. It's a story of family rivalry told through basketball. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And now it's time for Dorothy's List, our series about the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Each month during the school year, we visit with a group of middle grade readers to discuss one of the books nominated for the Vermont-based award. Today, VPR's Amy Noyes takes us to Rutland Town, where a group of middle schoolers have been reading this year's Newbery Medal winner, The Crossover, by Kwame Alexander. It's a story of family rivalry told through basketball.
7th and 8th graders at Rutland Town School are bounce passing and showing off their basketball moves, including the move their latest read was named for, The Crossover. This group of kids has been reading The Crossover together, and when I met them for a book discussion in the school library, they raved about it.
I liked it.
10 out of 10.
10 out of 10. Excellent. Does everyone feel that way?
Yeah. I liked it.
They're not alone. The Crossover is flying off library shelves like a half-court sinker. It's a novel in verse about identical twins, Josh and Jordan, who are basketball stars at their middle school. Their dad is a former professional baller. Their mom is assistant principal at their school. The story is told from Josh's point of view. One of the big changes in Josh's world is that his twin brother Jordan has started spending more time talking to girls and less time playing ball with him. The tension between Josh and Jordan escalates, and they both do regrettable things. One of those actions leads Josh to write an apology letter to his brother. At Rutland Town School, the students put themselves in Josh's shoes and tried writing their own letters to Jordan, whose nickname is JB. Here's 8th grader Amy McGee reading part of her letter.
Dear JB, the other day, while we were in the game, I made a huge mistake. I let my personal feelings get in the way of the game, but I also let them get in the way of our twin relationship. I think that it is about time that I told you what's been bothering me and gave you a reason why I hurt you the way I did. I'm jealous.
The apology poem that author Kwame Alexander wrote from Josh to JB in The Crossover is called Dear Jordan. It's written in two columns, and the author says it can actually be read several different ways, top to bottom, left to right, or diagonally. Here he is reading part of the poem.
Dear Jordan, I am empty with no net. My life was shattered on the court. Can you run with me like we used to, stealing sun, burning up? P.S. I'm sorry.
The students at Rutland Town School also had some questions for the author. Kyle DelBianco wanted to know,
why did you choose to write the book in poetry form?
We put Kyle's question and questions from his classmates to Kwame Alexander.
I like to think that basketball is like poetry in motion. I mean, you imagine Steph Curry like going behind his back with the ball, or Allen Iverson doing its crossover, or Michael Jordan or LeBron James like moving to the basket in this sort of rhythmic, energetic, sort of just really awesome way. I mean, what better way to capture that energy, that movement from the court, and to put that on the page than through poetry? I mean, because basketball is poetry in motion, and so I thought, let's use verse, let's use rhyme, let's use free verse, let's use different types of poetry to sort of mimic and mirror that action on the court and do that on the page.
The Crossover is a story of twins, but 7th grader Devin Kibbe noticed that readers get the point of view of only one brother.
How did you decide that you were going to write the story from Josh's perspective?
Wow, never been asked the question before. Devin, good question. I think Josh was the first character I wrote. So I knew that the book would be told from the vantage point of a boy, that it was going to be a 12-year-old boy. I was going to sort of remember what I went through during that age, and I sort of, you know, knew that that was going to be the point of view from his perspective. And so that was the first character that I created. And then I knew that there were going to be parents, and eventually, after maybe a draft of it, I knew that I wanted him to have a twin brother. So it was chronological. It began with Josh. It began with this 12-year-old boy who came to be known as Filthy McNasty.
Josh's dad gives him the nickname Filthy McNasty. Alexander says he came across the name while working on the story.
I listen to instrumental jazz when I'm writing, and I looked over and to see what song it was, and it was a song by Horace Silver called Filthy McNasty, and decided, I am so going to use that name in this book.
Alexander also found a way to sneak some of his favorite words into the book. First, he would use the word in a poem, then he would write a second poem to define the word. He says this all started with one synonym for beautiful in this passage from The Crossover.
While Vondi and JB debate whether the new girl is a knockout or just beautiful, a hottie or a cutie, a layup or a dunk, I finish my vocabulary homework and my brother's vocabulary homework, which I don't mind since English is my favorite subject, and he did the dishes for me last week. But it's hard to concentrate in the lunchroom with the girls' step team practicing in one corner, a rap group performing in the other, and Vondi and JB waxing poetic about love and basketball. So when they ask, "What do you think, Filthy?" I tell them, "She's pulchritudinous." Oh my goodness, what a word, Amy. I love that word, pulchritudinous. And so I was like, I got to use this word. And then, of course, I thought, what middle grade kid or teacher, for that matter, is going to know what that word means?
Alexander says he found a way to get the word in the passage while still moving the story along.
Pulchritudinous, having great physical beauty and appeal, as in every guy in the lunchroom is trying to flirt with the new girl because she's so pulchritudinous. As in, I've never had a girlfriend, but if I did, you better believe she'd be pulchritudinous. As in, wait a minute, why is the pulchritudinous new girl now talking to my brother?
Seventh grader Matthew Goulette wonders where Alexander's ideas for the crossover came from.
Is this story based on your life or someone you know?
No, it's not autobiography. It's not memoir. It's completely fiction. It's made up. Sure, you know, writers, we write from observation, imagination, experience. So certainly there's some things from my life that have probably creeped into this book. My mom was a school principal. You know, my dad played basketball before I was born. And when I was born, he was a PhD. So I didn't get the cool dad. I got the academic scholar dad who made me read books. So, yeah, it was it's fiction. But certainly there are parts of my life that I remembered and drew from.
The crossover has been winning top prizes and awards in children's literature. Seventh grader Dylan DiPietro wonders how that feels.
How did you react when you learned that the crossover won the 2015 Newbery Award?
Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! Oh my goodness! Like, how did I react? I danced around my room. My wife and I danced. My daughter, who's 7 years old in second grade, Samaya, she woke up. And she came in the room and said, what's all the commotion for? And we said, Daddy just won the Newbery Medal. And she said, yay. Now, can you go make my French toast, please? So, we kept her home all day. And we just sort of got on the couch and lit the fire and just smiled, laughed, danced, and just sort of bask in the joy of this wonderful honor. It's still a little tough to talk about because it's overwhelming. It's life-changing. I'm still reacting to it, and it's wonderful. And I'm so thankful.
And after that type of success, Rutland Town 7th grader Joe Anderson wanted to know if there's more to come.
Will there be a sequel with Josh and Jordan playing high school basketball?
Wouldn't it be cool to write a sequel where they're playing high school basketball and they go to college and get drafted into the NBA? Unfortunately, that wouldn't be a middle grade novel. You know, that'd be a high school novel or a young adult novel or an adult novel for that matter. So it's, you know, if I could figure out what to do with a sequel to make it still compelling and meaningful and significant and keep it in that era, sure. But I'm not there. However, I will tell you this. I am writing a prequel to The Crossover. And it is about the father when he was 12 years old. So I'm very excited about that.
And that's not the only story Alexander has been working on. He has a book coming out in April about a soccer player who doesn't like to read. It's called Booked. Come spring, these Rutland Town readers may be inspired to head out to the soccer pitch as well. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is The Crossover by Kwame Alexander. Special thanks to librarian Teresa Zahir at Rutland Town School. Next month on Dorothy's List, El Defo. It's a graphic memoir by author and artist Cece Bell. Bell lost her hearing as a preschooler, and her hearing aids made her feel different from her old friends. It wasn't until Cece went to a school for deaf children that she felt like she fit in again. Here's an excerpt from El Defo.
At the end of summer, it's time to start kindergarten. I now have definite proof that Emma and I are different. She gets on one bus, and I get on the other. I don't know where Emma goes, but I take a terrifying bus ride holding the hand of a mysterious woman with a serious afro. The bus stops in front of what I think is my new school. The woman from the bus leads me down a hallway. We stop at a door.
That was Rutland Town student Tatiana Pratt reading from El Defo. It's next month's selection in our series Dorothy's List, which is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, we're broadcasting live from the State House. We'll talk about the projects, priorities, and debates to come in the following months as lawmakers reconvene in Montpelier. You can send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. We'll not only be talking about what's going to be in the session, but we'll be talking with leaders of all three parties to discuss what they think are the top priorities, what they hope to accomplish, and what they see as the sticking points in the session to come. Again, that's tomorrow live at noon from the State House, and send your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.